Good morning. On behalf of my partners at RBC, thank you for joining us for the next session of our Back to School Energy Seminar covering pipelines and market access. I'm Robert Kwan, and I'm pleased to be joined by Al Monaco, CEO of Enbridge, and Alex Pourbaix, CEO of Cenovus. The format of this panel will be Q&A, and if you have any questions for Al or Alex, you can submit them via the Veracast platform using the Ask the Question tab, and we'll try to weave those into today's session. So Al and Alex, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thanks, Robert.
No worries.
All right. So, you know, let's start with where we are today with egress, and I'll start with Al. Where's the main line today, volume and operations-wise? If you can talk about the split between light and heavy lines, but more importantly, you've expressed that you expect the main line to be pretty much back to full in early 21. So with that, what are you doing to ensure supply has the access to the best markets? And what do you see as that apportionment outlook as you get into the second half of this year and into 2021?
Okay. Well, let me try it this way, Robert. You know, if you go back to the beginning of the year, we had thought we'd be at about 2.85 million barrels a day for the year. Obviously, in Q2, the world changed. Gasoline demand was off 40%. Jet was down 60%. You know, the good news is that we saw a pretty good supply response in North America. WCSB reacted pretty quickly by about a million barrels a day. Rail came off and some local refinery was down, but we were off about 400,000 out of that 2.85. In Q2, we had actually predicted a little bit more, so we were happy with where we ended up, I guess. And in the context of a pretty devastating hit to the economy, I think we fared pretty well. Now, on your question about where we're going to be, we're thinking we'll be around 200 to 400 off, and then gradually refilling from there for Q3 and Q4 to get back to near full actually by the end of the year. Now, that's in total. If you look at the heavy volumes, July apportionment came in pretty heavy. So we're full on our heavy system, and we expect that to carry through to the rest of the year. Lights is a different story. That'll be more gradual through the second half and then in early 21. You know, in terms of what we're doing about ensuring we're getting to the best markets, I think this probably goes back, Robert, to what I like to call the natural synergy between the WCSB basin and the end-use market. And we have the luxury of our system being connected to a great natural source of demand for heavy in the Midwest and the Gulf Coast. And they have excellent scale and complexity in those refineries. They need a reliable heavy diet. And as we saw in the second quarter and then into July, those refineries were the last to sort of shutter down and then the first to ramp up. And the Canadian part of the story is a cost-competitive heavy supply, and that played out really well in Q2 in terms of our deliveries and the refinery utilizations in those key first-class refiners. So, you know, the way we look at it, the role we play in all of that is being the midstream part, make sure we have the lowest possible tolls. Another thing that people, I think, often forget, we're not a bullet system. We have optionality to multiple markets, including quite nicely the full path down to the U.S. Gulf. So that's important. We think we provide pretty good flexibility operationally to our customers, multiple products. We try and maintain quality as best we can. Storage has turned out to be a huge value. We've always built up a lot of operational storage and our ability to reroute crude. So I think that's been a good harbinger for us. In terms of the future, we think it's more of the same, and it's all about really adding capacity and optimization with very little investment and obviously keeping the tolls as flat as we can for the customer. So one marker we always used is what's our planned and unplanned maintenance numbers, and those have really come up in terms of uptime, I guess, if you want to call it that, over the last few years. So good job in optimizing the system, I think, by the team, which has really served, I think, the customers pretty well.
That's great, Al. So turning to Alex, can you talk about where you are in terms of egress, and really what are the most important factors that drive your transportation strategy, whether that be pipelines or crude by rail? And with that, how are you thinking about the diluent recovery units?
Sure. Thanks, Robert. And when I talk about our transportation strategy, as Al alluded to, I'll probably more think about it on a medium to long term because, as Al said, the last 6 or 7 months have just been crazy. And I'm kind of thinking about this kind of as we move back into a more normalized situation. But, I've been pretty clear on this. For our company, I mean, my view is there really hasn't been an issue that is more important for us than market access. And I think it'd be fair to say that we see market access as probably both the greatest current challenge and also opportunity for Canadian barrels. And as I said, it's really been a priority for us. And our transportation strategy is really simple after a lot of analysis. But basically, our goal is to get our barrels to markets where they can achieve global pricing, which represents the best value for the product. And as an old pipeliner myself, I think it is very clear that pipelines remain the optimal mode of transportation for crude oil. It is both cost-effective and very safe way to get our barrels to premium markets. And, I think the rail aspect is really, for us right now, it is a flexibility strategy. We've built a portfolio of market access options for our barrels, and a big part of that has been our rail program. And based on the economics in March and April, we suspended the crude by rail program because it just didn't make sense in that environment. But we do see going forward, as we see barrels come back on in Alberta and elsewhere, I suspect we're going to be in a situation where rail, once again, is a pretty valuable tool to provide ex-Alberta egress. And as for the DRU, we really look at it as a potential option to further expand our market access while also enhancing our value chain. And what I mean by that, I'd kind of describe the attractiveness of the DRU as twofold. First, we believe that it can come very close to replicating pipe economics to get barrels to the Gulf Coast. And secondly, it has a collateral benefit as it really reduces our reliance on diluent and moving diluent all around North America, which is a huge cost to our business. We think it's something, and I've said this many times, I think under improved market fundamentals, I think it's something that could make sense. But right now for Cenovus, balance sheet and deleveraging are our priority. So it's not something that I anticipate will be advancing anytime soon.
Okay, that makes sense. To me, an interesting aspect of having both of you with us today is your alignment on what's been a somewhat contentious strategy to convert the Enbridge Mainline from the current common carrier system to a contracted system, and that being in front of the Canada Energy Regulator right now. Starting with Al, can you just hit on the key aspects of the contracting proposal that's in front of the CER and just talk about what it means to Enbridge?
Okay. Well, you said contentious. I think that's probably a good way to put it, but it's also, I think, unique, Robert, in that we have a challenge here because we're trying to strike a balance right from day one when we started this that satisfies a whole variety of customers, whether it's a producer, a marketer, or a refiner. And, we didn't just throw this out there. We spent a good 2 years talking to our customers and negotiating with them. And I would have to say it was a painstaking negotiation that resulted in some pretty good shipper support here. So, The key to me is from the start, our customers were very clear, and I think Alex alluded to this. What people told us is they want guaranteed access to the mainline to the best markets. They want toll certainty to protect their margins, and they want to continue to incentivize us to continue to optimize their system and grow it. And they're also pretty clear, which is the corollary to that, that they didn't want cost of service, and because that brings volatility in tolls. And perhaps most importantly, the current CTS has worked extremely well in that it aligns us with the customers on cost and capital management and quality and all the kinds of things that we do to try and bring value. So that's the that's the big picture on this. For producers, the way I look at it anyway, is for a long time, producers told us what they wanted was a level playing field with refiners. And the key to that, of course, is having transportation capacity, which now they have an option to have. And I think that's been the biggest thing. It gives them control over the barrels and the option to multiple markets so they can actually maximize their netback. And we'll see what Alex says, but to me, you don't want to be a price taker, and I think as a producer, having that capacity will certainly help them. At least that's our view. And I think it also provides them certainty in terms of future upstream investments that they will look at in the future. On the refinery side, though, if you look at it from their point of view, and what we've heard back is they want a reliable feedstock source. And for them, it's all about maintaining high refinery utilization. So they need that reliability, and they want to make sure that they have a good chance to earn premium margins given the coking investments that they've made. So that's how we look at it. Maybe just a final thing on this, Robert, because it's been contentious, as you say. We went back and forth and really redesigned some of the key things based on the concerns that we heard. So the final product, I think, is looking pretty good. We've got options on how they contract. A take or pay is there, or requirements contracts is there where it certainly has a lot less balance sheet impact to producers. The volume that we're talking about is relatively small for the smallest of producers, 2,200 barrels a day. And then probably the biggest thing is for volume commitments on either contract, you've got substantial toll discounts. All of that will translate into at or below the current toll. So we've really sort of tried to make this as attractive as possible to the widest variety of our customers. And of course, what it means for us, and you know this best in the big picture, is not only are we responding to what they're asking for, but we're resetting the mainline for a long time into the future with committed volumes. And I think that ultimately that helps the resiliency of the cash flows of the business. So maybe a long answer, but that's how we look at this offering.
Great. Thanks, Al, for that. And so for Alex, a number of investors have expressed to me that they feel that this is a Canada versus U.S. issue or a net producer versus a refiner issue. But obviously, Cenovus has supported this initiative, including submissions with the regulator, and that puts you alongside of, I think, over 70% of current volumes on the mainline, filing support for the contracting proposal. What are the main reasons behind your support for the contracting proposal versus some of your peers in Western Canada that have chosen to oppose it?
Yeah, Robert, it is interesting, and as Al alluded to, it has been a little contentious. But for me, I always really try to simplify strategy and ideas as much as possible. And you heard me in that last answer talk a little bit about that market access, in my view, has been the single biggest issue impacting the valuation of my company by the investment community. And you look at the Enbridge Mainline, and for decades, it's been dominated by refiners due to a number of factors. And Al alluded to a couple of those, but I mean, most notably, I think from our perspective, you know, in order to ship on the mainline, you have to meet the downstream verification standards. And the outcome of this has been, you know, for decades, Alberta producers mostly sell in Alberta to refiners or marketers who've then regularly been able to take advantage of this situation to obtain huge discounts on the value of the oil. And I actually had our guys do the numbers, and I can't remember the exact value transfer, but it is in the tens of billions of dollars of wealth have been transferred from the upstream to the downstream. And you know, I look at Enbridge's proposal for us, for the first time, it creates a fair playing field where Alberta producers can contract for firm capacity to U.S. markets and finally be able to control our own destiny. And I really see our position on this is pretty straightforward. We see contract carriage. It's a bit of a bird-in-hand route to a near-term increase to firm ex-Alberta egress. And, you know, I think from our perspective, having firm takeaway capacity is going to increase the value of Canadian resources. That's good for Cenovus. We think it's good for Canada. It's certainly good for Alberta. You know, and I have been hearing some arguments over the last little while that the criticality of this proposal is reducing with progress on TMX and frankly, maybe a more negative view on WCSB production as a result of COVID. But, you know, I really look at it, and if I were to list the reasons why we're supportive and continue to be supportive, they're pretty simple. First, and obviously, certainty of market access. It addresses the challenges in the nomination process. And as I said, it levels the playing field between producers and refiners. Second, competitive toll structure. We believe that the proposed tolls are competitive, and we're confident that the CER process will ensure they are. Third, it will enable full volumes on our downstream pipeline commitments. A lot of people will know we have significant volume on Flanagan South, and due to apportionment, most months we're not even able to fill our Flanagan South space. And finally, it's an in-service pipeline. There's no regulatory challenges. There's no further environmental reviews or approvals. So other than the CER process, so really for us, it gives us that certainty of getting our barrels on a firm basis to market. And so for all those reasons, for me, I mean, I really found it a very compelling situation for Cenovus.
Great. And Alex, I'm going to stick with you and shift, though, to a question on Western Canadian supply. And you do you think Alberta's curtailment policy, you know, has been a success? Do you think it should eventually be phased out? And over the longer term, you know, what type of supply growth do you see coming out of the WCSB?
Sure. So, you know, my view, and obviously I was quite involved in this debate, but you know, I think my view is the curtailment tool did really absolutely achieve what it was put in place to do, and that was to stabilize the WTI-WCS differential that enabled companies operating in Alberta to get the value they needed for their barrels and frankly, to go a little further, probably staved off an absolute crisis in the Alberta market where we had $40 and $45 differentials and the you know, large portions of the business were at risk of insolvency, and you had a government that was literally we were exporting barrels for nothing, and just wasting that resource. The government was getting no royalty dollars out of those sales, so it just needed to be addressed. You know, I think from my perspective, I said it at the time, I would say it now. Curtailment, I don't think it is a long-term solution. As I kind of alluded to earlier, I think pipelines are the obvious long-term solutions, but because of policy issues and regulatory issues, those pipelines that the market is demanding are still not here. So we needed that curtailment policy in place to address a breakdown in the policy and the politics around pipelines. I think, you know, I'd speak for myself. I'd probably speak for everybody in the market. You know, I'd like to see curtailment go away, because that would mean we fixed our market access challenges. But, you know, I just remind people that the moment the province produces one barrel over the takeaway capacity, those diffs are going to blow out again. And that is why it is so important to get the pipelines, and in the absence of the pipelines, to making sure we have this policy tool. You know, I think just in terms of where the industry is going in terms of production, my take, as Al said, you know, we had a really strong supply response to the COVID pandemic. But I generally am an optimist about this industry from the perspective that, you know, I look at what my company and our competitors have done in terms of driving our costs down. We are extraordinarily competitive right now in our costs, and I just have a general view that whatever pipeline capacity is available leaving the province, we're ultimately going to fill it, because those barrels are going to be competitive globally. And so, you know, I think I don't know that we're ever going to go back to adding, you know, 1 million barrels a year or 800,000 barrels a year, but I very much expect that the industry will continue to grow to meet the egress capacity out of the province.
That's great. And for Al, I don't know if you have any additional thoughts on the curtailment policy. I think we'd be interested to hear them, but also more specific to Enbridge, what would you highlight with respect to ensuring supply has access to both the core markets as well as the ability to expand market share into newer markets?
Yeah, I'm going to leave the constraints issue, because Alex covered it well, and I'm aligned with his thoughts. So maybe on the second part, you know, maybe I'll just explain how I see Canadian crude fitting in the broader global picture here, to go to your question, Robert. You know, Alex is the expert, but we look at this from a strategic perspective as well. You know, these reserves that we're talking about in the oil sands generally are long-lived, and a high degree of certainty comes from that. Minimal reinvestment compared to some of the other growth areas for crude oil in North America. And producers, as he just alluded to, amazing job on cost, but also on lowering emissions. And so I see, and for our business, a pretty big opportunity for Canadian producers in gaining market share. And if you go back to 2013, Canadian share of the U.S. Gulf Coast was about 5%. And now we're roughly around 30, and I think we're heading to about 50% over time here, especially when you consider where Venezuela and Mexico are at these days. And the U.S. Gulf Coast, I don't care what period of time you look at it, it's always been the best market, along with the U.S. Midwest, because it's scale, it's complexity of refineries, and its competitiveness. So when you look at all of that, and you look at our position, it's all about capturing more of that. And I think, you know, the contracting proposal we have helps that. We've got a full path and joint toll structure to the heart of the Gulf. And we're really focused on now that what we call the last mile for the full value chain. So what I'm talking about there is terminaling and blending services that provide options for producers once they're in the Gulf, so they can actually move volumes to refineries or they have an outlet. So for us, that's about terminals and VLCC offshore capability. So overall, I think the story here is optimistic in terms of Canada and Alberta specifically gaining market share in what is, I think, the best market.
Great. I'll stick with you, Al, just as we think about pipeline projects. And on the main line, you've got an expansion via the Line 3 replacement program, as well as work on Line 5 through the Straits of Mackinac and the longer-term tunnel project under the Straits. you gave a number of updates, obviously, on your second quarter call. Is there anything new on those fronts? And as well, just what do you see as the key messages, you know, out to the market as it relates to those initiatives?
Okay. Well, look, these two things have been headlines for us for a while, and, you know, they're obviously critical to us, but just for context, the Enbridge of today is quite different than it has been in the past. We generate roughly $14 billion of EBITDA annually from 40 different sources of cash flow. So, you know, the projects are very critical, but less so for us these days. Line 3, number one for sure, this is a safety-related project. The Canadian system is in. Wisconsin work is done. North Dakota is now in construction. The only remaining piece, as everybody knows, is Minnesota. I would say, Robert, we're definitely in the late innings of this one. It's been a long game. But certainly the PUC process has now come to conclusion. That was a big outcome, and we're focused on the detailed permits here. We're expecting the state and federal permits later this year. You know, maybe just a comment on some of the things around legal challenges, which is usually where people go on these things. On this one, we've had 5 years of review in what I would call the most extensive and thorough process I've ever seen, and that's a good thing. We've had, you know, an ALJ process, a full EIS twice. The PUC approved it twice, and we've responded to a number of appeals. The biggest thing I would say about this in terms of the message and what's different here is that we have excellent support from towns, counties, right away landowners, obviously labor, but critical to all of it is the tribes, and particularly where the pipeline runs through. And I think this has just been a very good story. It doesn't get played out that way, obviously, but certainly we're proud of the amount of support we've got for this. So that's line 3. If you want me to just spend 2 seconds on line 5, just as critical a project to the state of Michigan in terms of propane demand and the gasoline we supply there. This line and this crossing is safe today. I think we've had a number of parties verify that. But we have been responsive to people's concerns here, and I think that's why we're looking to build a new crossing, and I think we're moving along there pretty well. We filed our applications, and of course, the legislation has now been confirmed in the courts, so we're on our way there as well.
Great. Alex, you know, how would Cenovus deal with a material delay if there was one for line 3 or some sort of extended outage for line 5? And when it comes to, you know, projects or initiatives like this, you know, how do you work with pipeline companies to help support these projects?
Sure, Robert. You know, you know, I think the good news is, you know, during the currency of these challenges, you know, neither Enbridge, you know, nor its competitors have been standing still. And we look at it, there's been a number of developments that have really kind of de-risked that supply takeaway imbalance and have led to keeping the WTI WCS differential fairly narrow. And, you know, obviously rail capacity is there to add flex to the system. You know, you've seen out of the midstream business a lot of progress on pipeline optimization projects. You know, the Alberta government curtailment plan, although as I alluded to, isn't a permanent solution, it has certainly allowed us to respond in a more profitable way to this challenges. But and things like the government implementing the rail above curtailment programs. And then, you know, the COVID impact that Al talked about in the opening, you know, it's given us a little bit of a cushion while we wait for these projects. You know, and I would say in addition to those developments, Cenovus has been very proactive in setting up options. I've already talked about our rail business. You know, and we have more than a full year to watch for progress on those projects and decide, you know, where the differential looks like it'll be in 22 or 2022 and beyond. And as I said, you know, not something I anticipate we'll be moving on anytime in the near future, but ultimately the DRU represents another long-term structural solution in the event that those kind of delays were to continue. You know, we are watching quite carefully to see if we think there's going to be a call for rail. I've said this many times. The rail business, we think it works pretty well, but we think it's a business that does not at all benefit from being yanked up and down like a yo-yo. So if we ramp up our rail business, we want to do it with the view that that's something we're going to be doing for 6-12 months. And so really right now, you know, we're just watching that. We're watching where diffs are going. And if we thought they were going to be expanding into that, you know, those sort of high teens, that would obviously be an option we'd be looking at.
Got it. Maybe taking a step back and just thinking about, you know, pipeline and transportation markets, and I'll start with Alex, but really the question is for both of you. Alex, you know, starting with kind of you got your perspective as a user of pipelines, and you noted earlier pipelines being the best mode of transportation, and you spent time on the other side as a pipeline proponent and the trials and tribulations of that. You know, how do you think the energy landscape has changed with Bill C-69 and the related new regulatory processes as you think about future transportation, as well as just some of the developments we've seen in the U.S., including what's happened to DAPL, and how do you think about what that means for existing transportation?
Sure. I'll try to unpack that. You know, that is a pretty fraught discussion, but you know, I certainly have some views on it. And you know, I guess I'll start out with some good news. And you know, I would emphasize that the new Impact Assessment Act, and for those of you who aren't aware, that was the act that is actually followed from Bill C-69. I think just for convenience sake, I'll call it Bill C-69. You know, it is only going to impact future projects that have not yet received approval. And you know, as I said, the good point of that is it's not going to impact any of the previously sanctioned projects or projects already reviewed. And so that would capture Keystone XL, TMX, Line 3, et cetera. But you know, let me be very blunt. In my view, and I was very public at the time, but Bill C-69 is bad law. It massively increases the cost and uncertainty of all major infrastructure projects. And I think for me, the thing that I find very problematic is the number of new criteria it added for regulators to assess, such as the impact of the project on climate change, and there were many others. But they're really very, very difficult, both for proponents, but frankly, for regulators to assess, and certainly for proponents to handicap, you know, what the impact will be. And I think at the end of the day, you know, no one in our industry or in the midstream industry is looking for a free ride. All we're looking for is an environmental assessment process that creates, you know, both public and investor confidence, which we think would be better for the environment and the economy. And I guess I would add, I'd go on a little bit and say that I don't think the government should rely on the explicit climate change regulations that they've already put in place to mitigate GHG emissions, things like the carbon pricing system. And I really do not think that the regulatory impact assessment process is a true tool to control GHG emissions across the economy. You know, Cenovus and I have been very consistent on this, but I don't think that market-based, sorry, I said that the wrong way. I do believe market-based climate policy is by far the most cost-effective way to reduce GHG emissions, and while also supporting the economic recovery. And I just would make the observation that creating barriers to building energy infrastructure is not a cost-effective way to reduce GHG emissions, or to support an economic recovery. And I, you know, maybe I'll finish off just talk a little bit about your observation around DAPL and a number of the other delays in the U.S. And, you know, from my perspective, you know, it really highlights the ongoing legal issues around new infrastructure projects. And in my view, you know, I think this is a reality, but most federal, state, and in Canada, provincial and federal infrastructure permitting and environmental review legislation really never contemplated the present situation where environmental opponents have been able to form shop to find attractive jurisdictions or judges to launch lawsuit after lawsuit and inevitably followed by appeal up through the courts. And these, I mean, everybody has seen this, these never-ending lawsuits, judicial reviews, appeals, add years to the approval process. And I think it's actually really, really important that governments at all level kind of address this situation. You know, everybody, you have to have an ability to appeal a bad administrative decision or regulatory decision. But to create this world where opponents can just, in essence, stall projects for years, if not decades, just by utilizing the courts at various levels, I don't think that was ever contemplated by government. And I think the only way to fix that is by government taking a real hard look at that.
Great. Thanks, Alex. So, Al, you know, any comments here just on, you know, future projects, but as well, you've got your part ownership in DAPL. You're fortunate enough with some of your existing systems to help those customers if there ends up being an issue to move it on some of your wholly owned systems. But what do you make kind of the whole situation?
Yeah, well, just a quick point on C69. I agree with what Alex said. You know, for us, though, the reality is we do so much with the Canadian Energy Regulator day to day. You know, for us, it was equally important to make sure that daily oversight, you know, moved on smoothly, which didn't really change that much, which was, I guess, part of the good news. But I'll be blunt as well. I mean, there is no doubt that that process is going to create more uncertainty. And so if and when we do see mega projects come along from here, which, you know, I don't see in the immediate future, we're going to be very cautious about deploying capital. We've been down this road before with a major project that ended up being canceled. So we're certainly not going down that road again without a lot of caution. But your broader questions, I think, are really good. Obviously, the landscape has changed here. Alex is right about the construct regulatory-wise not being designed for it. I think really what's happened here is that there's really less reliance by the judicial community on precedent. Courts no longer really defer to regulators or quasi-judicial bodies. I think that's been the major change that we've seen. But, you know, I have to say our approach to this around execution of projects shifted a long time ago. We assume everything is going to be challenged. We plan for longer upfront consultation, longer approval process, and costs are going to be higher. That's how we plan things, and thankfully we've been able to get a lot of things done. The other thing, though, that I think is really important here is economic participation with communities, particularly First Nations and tribes. We've had a very good experience on that front. And the other thing that's really important is build what we call coalitions of support. You need labor, you need community, you need the support from the rest of your value chain, you need independent experts, and you need landowners. And I think this it requires a huge new skill set for the midstream value chain, and I think we've done okay on that. Last point on this, in terms of, and I think this is maybe most important for investors, how we look at strategy and capital allocation in this kind of environment. And really, it's about how do you capitalize on the inherent value of what you already have in the ground. It means you're expanding incrementally to phase with production. It means you're focused on organic expansions and extensions of what you have in the ground. And I think you've got to prioritize your capital to jurisdictions that support development. And in the end, you've got to be very careful about deploying development capital and risk capital before you have a pretty good degree of certainty. And all of this actually comes through in the, you know, the hurdle rates that you set for these projects. So that's how we look at it, Robert.
That's great. This has been a great discussion, and unfortunately, we're now at the end time and we're out of time, so we'll have to wrap it up here. On behalf of the team at RBC, thank you very much, Al and Alex, for joining us today, and thank you to all of you on the webcast. Thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Thanks a lot, Robert. Take care.